This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Hi, my name is Witkalki Zwin. And right now I'm an MC, a host of Vietnamese concerts, television shows, talk shows. But in my previous life, I was a lawyer. I am a mother still. I'm a business person and entrepreneur. So I'm like what you say, jack of all trades, but master of none. Oh, except for maybe master ceremony. Okay. That one, I think I got it down.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Thank you for that. What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you?
I think it means that you still understand the culture. Not necessarily that you have to speak Vietnamese or that you have to live in Vietnam, but if you can understand the culture, things that are relevant to Vietnam or the Vietnamese community, that you're concerned about it, that you have some understanding, and you live in the communities, you have a lot of Vietnamese friends, and I think that's what it means to be Vietnamese, just an awareness that I am Vietnamese.
As the sort of the focal point, so many people know of the work that you do at Paris by Night and such a, you know, out front person. Does that experience weigh down on your shoulders in terms of the way that you carry yourself in the real world or your present life?
Actually, I think people who've met me off the stage will say, hey, they're surprised. How come in outside in real life, you're just exactly as you are on stage? And I think that maybe that contributes to the way I relate to people, and people feel that they're closer to me, and therefore, you know, I think it definitely contributes to part of my success as being an MC, and that is just being yourself. I started with very low expectation. My MC job was just a side job that I do to put me through law school. I never thought that I'm going to be a professional MC. I never put a lot of, and that's why I never put a lot of pressure on myself. This is a part-time job that I'm going to do until I finish law school. And hey, everybody knows that I don't speak Vietnamese very well, because when I first started out, I actually don't read and write in Vietnamese. And my mom used to write my script for me, and it'll be like 30 pages long. And I have to memorize every word because I didn't have enough vocabulary to go off on my own to say whatever I want to say. So therefore, coming from that mindset that, hey, of course, I came to America when I was 10, and, you know, I've been, you know, through law school, like most of my friends are white, and I don't speak a lot of Vietnamese, so I don't put a lot of pressure on myself. The job started out as a part-time job, fun, it pays your school while you're going through college, and hey, you're not Vietnamese, so if you make a mistake on stage, who cares? Because at that time, most of my co-MCs are older gentlemen, anh Nam Lộc, anh Ngạc, who are so well-versed in Vietnamese that I put on their shoulder, hey, those guys are supposed to be good, okay? I'm not. So if I mess up, it's okay. So,
you know, that gives us
real life on stage, the same thing.
That gives all the young people, all the generations after you, a lot of hope, because a lot of us don't speak Vietnamese well. And we, you know, most of us, a lot of us are born here, and our language skills sometimes are, you know, really bad. And we want to learn and understand
Vietnamese more, and sometimes it's hopeless. So to hear you say that, you know, it's really, it's.
Yeah, I didn't read, I didn't write. My mom taught me at home. And it, just another note, I think as with anything that you approach in life, if you approach it in a playful way, that you're not so stressed out, that the journey is actually better than the destination, you'll have fun along the way and give yourself room to make mistakes and be okay about it. And I think that that somehow comes across, because I've seen other MC on stage, and when they, you know, read something wrong, they're like, you know, they're so tense up. And as an audience, you feel like you tense along with them, you know. But for me, if I inadvertently say something wrong, I'm like, I'm so sorry. Can we do it again and pretend that you haven't heard this and give me a clap, okay? And then therefore, you know, they feel, hey, you know, she's just like us. And they would laugh for me when I asked for it. Yeah.
So when you were growing up, did you have a sense of who your mom and dad was?
Oh, yes, of course. In Vietnam, we live on the air base Tân Sơn Nhất. But I always remember my brothers would go to school in helicopters because they're in boarding school. So every week a helicopter would come take them. But I think they were in Dala. I'm not sure. For myself, I would go to school always with a nanny and a bodyguard. In class, of course, they don't come in class with me, but they would stand outside. I hardly ever get to go out of the house to play. Like, we have a movie theater at home, so we would show movies at home. And it would be a treat for me to go to a regular movie theater to see. And in our house, we've always had maids and butler, like maybe 20 people, and guards, and, you know, three head chefs. So yes, I have an idea that I come from a different household.
So, yeah. So the reverse is another question that I might ask is, were you aware that there was, you know, people on the outside of your lifestyle and your family's lifestyle that were living differently?
Yes, I was, because surrounding my house for the airbase are all the quarters of all the, either the soldiers or the people that are the Air Force people or the guards, you know. So because I don't get to go outside and play, I always hang around with the sons and daughters of all the soldiers that live right outside my house. So we would love to go to their house and we play things like, you know, jump rope, nhảy dây, or, you know, bóng chuyền, I don't know English, you know, the ball and the chopstick. So we play all hopscotch, all the kids game, but all my best friends are actually sons of the help, the mates, the butler, the soldiers, the guards. So I actually have very few friends that are of any, you know, the generals or the high society. That my best friends are, and I would love to go to their house and eat. And all my brothers and sisters are the same. You know, my mom would have such a hard time. Here we are at our house with, you know, two or three head chefs. One would be for French dinner, one would be for Chinese. And my brothers would go over to play with his friends who are sons of like a soldier and wouldn't come home for dinner. So my mom have to bring them back and say, okay, tell me, what food are they serving that you want to eat? I'll make them. And they'll come up with things like canh bí, and, you know, just very people's food, you know?
Right.
And not only canh bí have to be cooked right, but it has to be sliced right. Like my mom is like, no, they cut it sideways. We want it exact, you know? So canh bí, and sometimes they would want things like mắm kho quẹt, which is just nước mắm, you know? So yeah, so we all grew up with our best friends like that. And we love it, so yeah.
And when you came to the United States, you were about 10 years old. And how were things different in terms of the way you saw the world?
The one thing that I think that I was so lucky, and luckier than my older brothers and sister, is that I've never experienced, quote unquote, the high life. You know what I mean?
Yes.
As a 8 or 9 years, like I said, you're playing hopscotch, you're running around the house. So I did not have that transition from going, like my brothers used to go, like when they go out, they're in their 20s, they were going to boarding school in London, the same school that Prince Charles went through, you know, like really they learned to play polo and, you know, ride horses. And when it came to me, none of those stuff. So I came here as a regular kid. You know, when I was 14 and a half, I got my first job serving food at a food court in a mall, you know, and I have no problem transitioning because there, but I know a lot of my mom told me about friends of, you know, general higher up people who, you know, like they're already grown up. So it's harder for them to come over here because I remember my mom's friend telling her, oh, my daughter, she was washing the dishes and she was crying because she's never had to do this, you know? So, but for me, it's no problem. So, yeah.
Well, so you're really fortunate in that way.
Yes, right? I'm lucky, right? Yeah.
Really lucky.
You do it. Yeah. So you don't miss anything. You don't miss, oh my God, I used to go and have four guards like bring suitcases of cash for me to, you know, No, I never had those. So, yeah.
So when your siblings came to the US, I mean, did they have trouble transitioning?
Well, I don't know because, you know, I was too young to talk to them. I don't really know what's going on in their mind. But, you know, they were guys, like four brothers. So with guys, they just try to hold things
it in.
They're not, yeah, so I wouldn't know anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, that's our culture, right? It's very difficult to communicate these sort of feelings.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many times I think children of publicly accomplished parents, they either go one way or the other. They either push and try to follow in the footsteps of sort of like this accomplished direction that their parents, or they just take a backseat and go the other way. What was the case with you?
I was a very rebellious kid. I'm one of those, like, if you say no, I'll try it, right? So as you can see, I don't like anything having to do with politics. You know, my parents were doing it, but for all that they've done, I don't think it was worth it. As proud as I am of them, after a while, especially for my mom, I felt that they live in a gilded cage. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So my mom, she likes simple things like singing, you know, going dancing, but she could never do that.
Right.
Because it's like, oh, you're Madame Gay. You cannot do this. You cannot do that. So I think in a way I did rebel, meaning I grew up going into entertainment was rebellious. You know, when I first started out and I was singing and dancing with Win Hung and wearing all those like really, you know, sexy skirt, lower back and stuff, that was not considered good in my family, especially my dad's, and both my dad and my mom's family are from the north. And they're really strict, you know. My dad is from Sun Tay, my mom is from Bắc Ninh, and the culture, you know, it's like you don't do entertainment. That is like nah, you know. Of course I rebelled. I did entertainment. I rebelled by not marrying someone that my mom would think that I should marry. We're not going to go into that. But yeah, so and so here I am, you know.
But ironically, sort of the years of progressing, the decades of the work that you do, you are kind of in the gilded cage if you think about it, right? Because you represent this the very ding dang form of the Vietnamese culture.
Gilded cages. I don't know if the audience put me there, but I don't feel that I'm there, meaning I still do everything that I want. As long as I only have two rules that I go by, as long as it's not something that I cannot sleep with, you know, of my own, what I think is right. And as long as I'm not hurting anyone and I'm living by a certain moral code that I think we all innately have. If I satisfy those two things, I wouldn't say I don't care, but I don't mind so much what the public thinks about me. So for example, if I'm not happy in my marriage, I get a divorce. I can say, well, I have been divorced twice. There's nothing that I feel that I should hide because right. I'm afraid that the public would say, oh, yes or no, you know, or I mean, I'm dating a younger guy than me now. There's no problem with that, you know. So anything that I do that I think is not hurting anyone, I'm going to do it. I'm going to dress a certain way. Maybe right now you see I got butterflies in my hair and I was doing this and people might think, oh, you know, she's that, you know, how old is she and why she's wearing butterfly in her hair? Because I think it's good. You know, it's my daughter's butterfly clip. It's not being young or whatever. And if people say, oh, she's trying too hard to be young, I'm like, so?
Nothing wrong with that.
If it's not hurting you,
yeah.
You know, and it makes me happy, then in that sense, I don't think I live for the public. And I never go online to read anything about myself. No, any YouTube, even when my friend's sending me something, I don't Google my name, except when I'm trying to look for something that, right. You know, that I did, but not to read things about what people say about me. Yeah.
I think the bigger you become, there's just so much room for people to write negative things.
But, you know, here's the thing. It's not whether you're bigger or more famous, but I think this would work for everyone. Is when people say something bad about you, just know it's their opinion.
Right.
It doesn't mean that you're bad. So for example, I'm sitting here looking at you. I said, Ken, I love your blonde hair. Or Ken, why did you dye your hair blonde? You know that your hair is not blonde. So you just laugh. Why would you let that affect you? It's just my opinion. It's a wrong opinion. Why would, so it's the same thing. Whether I say, hey, Ken, I like your, I don't like your blonde hair. Or, hey, Ken, you know, I don't like your work, or I don't like the way you talk, or and even when they go further, hey, Ken, you're a cheater. Like, how do they know what's inside of you? So the idea is you have to know what yes. you have inside. You have to know that, hey, I don't have blonde hair, you know? Hey, my name is Zuin, it's not Lan. So if you call me Lan, you can call me all day. I know I'm not Lan. So what's the difference between that and, hey, Zuin, you know, you sour, you lie all the time. As long as I know I didn't lie, who cares what you think? So, yeah.
But the rough part is if you kind of doubt your work or you doubt your own integrity and somebody calls you out, that is painful to deal with.
And they say that when people get really pissed and they lose control and they scream and yell, that's because there is something, a hint of truth that they feel that they have to defend. Whereas if someone throws you a negative thing and you know that's for sure it's not true, then your attitude is, you know, yeah.
But I think that's the hard part. Like for me, you know, if they're calling me out on my Vietnamese, you know, sometimes it's a little bit cringy because, you know, that's the truth. But at the same time, if you know yourself and if you can accept that about yourself, then you can improve it or you can just accept it and move on.
You know, your example of Vietnamese, I think that anything that they call you out on the outside, you know what I mean? Can be improved. Whether, okay, Zuin, you can be a better MC, you can be a better driver. Yes. It's the thing on the inside that they don't know, you know, like whether you have integrity, you know, whether you have certain moral, what's the word I'm trying to, torpitude. This one happens when you speak Vietnamese and English. To be Vietnamese also to me means to be half thịt ba rọi, half fatty, and half, you know, sometimes I just blank out and I can't think. Moral turpitude, right? There's the word. Sometimes I can't think of the word I'm trying to say in English.
So when you were in high school, did you sort of gravitate towards Vietnamese people? Did you hang out with a lot of them or did you have like a mixed bag of friends?
I went to Marina High School and it's in Huntington Beach, and a lot of rich kids go there. I mean, kids would go there, you mean 20 years ago in Lacoste shirts, you know, on the tennis team dress.
Yes.
I was never part of that clique group. I always have Vietnamese friends, and not only Vietnamese friends, the nerdy Vietnamese friend, not the one that are, you know, in student, VHS student, Vietnamese student something, or the ones that have all these activities. I was just two or three nerdy friends stick together, studying, and that's it. Yeah, never gotten involved in. Well, I was on the tennis team in the sport way, but never got involved as far as organizing anything. You know, be the spokesperson for this or that. No.
But that was in high school. But was that the same in college?
Yeah, college. I got through college. Just because my boyfriend went there and I wanted to be with him, and that's how I picked my school. I'm sorry to say, didn't put much thought into it, except, yeah. So, of course, when I'm there, because I'm with my boyfriend and didn't want mom to know that I have a boyfriend, I shy away from any activities wow. that would, you know, oh, I don't want mom to look through it, you know. Yeah. So, yeah.
And what did you end up...
Very rebellious, I told you, right?
But quiet, you're a quiet, rebellious person. Like you're undercover rebellious. What did you end up studying in college?
In college was international marketing management. And then in law school, it's law with emphasis on taxation.
These things have nothing to do with entertainment.
yes, no. Well, except I can write out my own contract. When people contract me to do something, I can write it out.
Yeah, and that's a big deal. But I mean, I can argue, I say that jokingly, but at the same time, I mean, if we really think about it, the training from, you know, going through the LSAT, you went through the LSAT, right, at the time? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Going through the LSAT, the critical thinking, the back and forth and the debates inside of a classroom, all of these things probably sharpened your wit when you are on stage dealing with somebody like Angan, right?
I think so. No, I think it sharpened my logical thinking. And I was able, as an MC, to distill a bunch of information down to something very easy to understand. Like when I go MC an event, let's say for a company, they would give me like 2 pages about their company, their missions, and what they want to do. And those are kind of things that when you step out, you have to introduce about the company. And rather than, you know, just reading off the script. And that's what happens to a lot of MC in Vietnam right now. They get to the event like about half an hour early because they're professional. They're giving a script. And of course, they're reading from the script. So with me, I would meet up with the organizer like a week ahead. Oh, wow. I would sit down and I would listen to them. I don't want the script that you've written to me. Why don't you talk to me? What is your company about? Well, what do you hope to do for the next 5 or 6 years? What is your mission? Is it to make money, you know? And when I talk to them, it's like, okay, now I have a friend. Now when I go on stage with what they've given me, I can distill it out, put it in very simple term, and just retelling the audience as if I'm making an introduction of something I'm so familiar with, you know, like, hey, you know, this is Ken. He has his podcast before he was. So,
and it's more organic.
And that logical training, thinking from law school, like cut through everything and get to the issue. What is the issue? Right. I think that helps me a lot.
So let's take it back to the origin story. I can't imagine your mother, your father at the time, you know, finishing up law school and saying, you know, I want to go out and get into the entertainment business. I mean, is this something that even mattered to them? Or did you kind of like, once you graduated, you're done?
Okay. So my mom had this one thing that she always requests of me. And she always say that, you know, I only have you. Well, I have brothers and sister, but biologically, my mom only had me. So from the second marriage, but she raised all of us together in one household since my sister was only like 2 years old. So we grew up, there was no distinction between which mom and which mom. But anyway, sometimes my mom would tell me, well, you know, I only have you. And the only thing I ever ask of you in terms of, like, so for you to be a lawyer. And why? She says, because we're in America and America is the land of law and you're a girl. So physically, you're not going to be able to defend yourself if someone to attack you. But if you know the law, then you can defend yourself. Because she said, in America, you know, the worst thing you can say to someone is I'll sue you. So she wanted to make sure that I can defend myself. So I didn't want to go, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do, but So I used that as a bargaining chip to her. I said, okay, you know, like you said, my mom always wanted to put me in that gilded cage also, you know, wanted me to hang out with certain groups of friends, to marry the type of man that she thinks, to go to the school that she thinks. So I said, okay, everything you've taught me and you keep pushing me, if I become a lawyer, now I'm free, right? Now I can hang out with whoever I want. I can marry whoever I want. I can do any career I want. So just because I'm a lawyer doesn't mean I have to practice law, right? Because you said this is only for me to protect myself.
Wow.
And she said, yes. So guess what? I just remember, like, throughout law school, I mean, the thing that I was driving across my, I'm going to get my law degree. And you know, my mom, she's going to be so proud. She's going to celebrate to show off, you know? Exactly what my daughters told me. Mom, don't show us off. Don't put our picture on Facebook, you know? So I said, you know, the pleasure is I'm going to take out my certificate and tear it. So many years, just so I can say I'm a lawyer. Just because I'm your daughter, then I have to be a lawyer. It's Vietnamese, right? Doctor, lawyers, or engineer. That's it. And this is just, you know, so I was just, you know, I did it for the rage and so that I have a chance to rebel. Fast forward, now my mom has passed away. 40 years later, I'm like, Mom, you're so right. Oh, you're so right. Meaning that even though it's different when I go into entertainment, if I'm not a lawyer, because I am a lawyer, I know that in the back of my mind, I always have my law license. I mean, it's still there. You can check me out on the law website. It's just inactive because I haven't practiced. So if I want to practice, I pay insurance, I take continuing education, boom, I can practice again. So that knowledge gives me the confidence to say, hey, you know, I'll try entertaining. If it never worked out, I have this. And also, I think in the Vietnamese audience, the way they look at me, because Vietnamese people, we really respect, you know, scholars, right? Even more than we respect rich people.
Right.
You know, Vietnamese, we have two terms. We can go, cái thằng chọc phú, like the nouveau rich, right? Gọi là cái thằng. But you can say, ví dụ như là, your teacher, it's always ông giáo, thầy giáo. And I've met people who have reunion with, anh nhạc, right? They're teachers that are like 20, 40 years ago, and the students are now so successful, so much richer, whatever. But when they see anh nhạc, they always say, thầy nhạc. It's the same respect. So therefore, I think because I went through all that, like pay my dues education-wise, that I think when I stand on stage, I do felt that bit of, you know, I don't know if it's like respect, but what I say has more weight than not gone through that. Yeah. So that's, and then it helps me in every area in life, even though I don't practice law, from everything, from buying a house to starting a business to talking with people. Like I said, I'm also an entrepreneur, to know the law when we start the business, how the taxation is going to be, boom, 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 boom. It's very detailed. And that all has helped me in my relationship, even personal relationship, the way I structure everything so that when we do have a breakup, nobody has to go to court. I'm not saying like have to sign a document, but yeah, we sign everything. Everything is clear. Should we break up? Boom, it's there. We don't have to fight over anything. Yeah. So yeah.
You know, this same philosophy of your mom and you sort of have met somehow in the middle. Now, when you are a parent now and your young children are coming up and you sort of have to form this third culture of relaying to them the strategy of the old country and the new way to do things, how did you formulate that with your family?
You know, if we think about it, part of what makes us who we are is how we inherit things from our parents, right? Like you say, right? Someone like, I know Anh Hoàng Thi, who's a musician. He is very devoted to his wife. He's a one man, one woman. It's because his father was a womanizer, you know, so they go the other way. For me, what I gave my kid is precisely, you're not in a gilded cage. Live for yourself. Don't care too much about, you know, the public. As long as you're happy, it's okay. You know, I have one daughter who is now in law school in England, and she's very happy. She wants to go there. I have one daughter who wants to go and be a professional chef. So she had 2 years of college, then say, Mom, you know, studying words is not for me. I want to go to chef school. So yeah, I put her through that. Now she's working as one of the chef, as one of the most famous and the hottest restaurant right now. It's called Nip. So she's so happy. And to me, both daughters have the same worth. The one who's going to school in England now to be a lawyer because she wants to. And I'm proud of them the same. And as long as they're happy and they don't have to do anything for Mom or, you know, I never talk about them because I've talked, Mom, you're showing off about us. So I hope they don't hear this podcast. Okay.
you know, at the end of the day, sometimes I think young people in their mind, they can fund it. They can differentiate if the parents are doing it out of the parents' ego or true care.
Right. We know, as
young, you know, as little kids, we know like, wait, that doesn't make sense. You're making me do this because you just want to show your
friends. It's for you. Yeah. So you can be proud. Yeah.
And that's a sort of distinction. I think that the people that grow up in the United States or people, even of my mom's generation who sort of can get it quickly, understand that, you know, you got to move the ego, brush it aside, and then really go into the practical side of raising kids in the new world.
Right. Yeah, I think as long as they're happy, and like, I guess the only thing that I try to instill in them, and another thing that I've learned, kids learn by observing you. And it's like osmosis.
Right.
They don't learn by you sitting down and lecturing them. If you sit down and you lecture them, but they see and they sense that you're doing things different, they're not going to know, you know, like my two girls, that they're rebellious against me, you know, but I see them when they're with other people and I'm not there. The thinking, the way they act is very much like me. And I have my friends said, oh, trời con chị dễ thương quá, you know, things like that. So I think they learn by, just
by watching.
Just being in the family. Like you say, people will say, oh, I have a very soft spoken voice. It's because my mom speaks to me like that. She has never yelled at me, despite, you know, even when we're in conflict, you know, when I was in my early 20s, you know, we were in conflict and she says, why don't you move out of the house? But in a nice way, like, okay, that is what I, con mẹ muốn như vậy. That's what I want. Nhưng mà nếu con không đồng ý thì con có thể dọn ra. But if you don't agree with me, then, you know, you're free to move out. And I'm like, dạ vâng, nếu mẹ nói như vậy thì con sẽ dọn ra. So yes, Mom, if you say that, I would like to move out. And that's the extent of our conflict.
That's not typical in Vietnamese culture, I'll tell you that. Yeah.
So now I cannot raise my voice. If I'm talking with someone and they're pissed and they start yelling, I would just be quiet. And I said, you know what? I'm going to walk away. We talk about this later. Because I can't yell back.
Right. That's the... Well, can we talk about your mom and dad a little bit? Because, you know, people in my generation, we've often read about your parents. From a distance, we've heard of it from our parents. But can you tell me your point of view and how you experienced your mom and how you experienced your own father?
Well, from what my mom told me, obviously I was not around there. Their love story is the stuff that can be written into the most beautiful novels, right? How, so she met him, she was an airline stewardess, Vietnam Airlines. But at that time, you know, being a stewardess, hôtesse de l'air is very prestigious. You have to be beautiful, you have to be a certain height, a certain weight. You have to speak, you know, French and English. So it's very prestigious. It's not just a waitress in the air.
Right.
So one of my dad's underling was harassing her. He was really smitten by her. But the way he approached her, he kept, you know, all the time, to a point where it becomes an harassment. So on one flight, my mom met my dad. He was traveling on a civilian airplane at that time. And so she just walked straight up to him and says, "General, can I have a word with you?
Wow.
You know, your underling so-and-so-and-so has just been bothering me. You know, he's courting me, but I already said no, but he's just doing this. So sure enough, to make a long story short, my dad intervened. And one of the best way to get this guy off of her tail is for my dad to marry her.
So did this courting happen just on one flight with this underling?
No. This is the first story. The courting happens, you know. You've all heard story about, for example, my mom told me that she, when he was courting her, she would be flying Vietnam Airlines Boeing to Hong Kong. He would fly his fighter jet. I don't know if it's F-14. I'm not really good, but whatever they had that time. Fly his fighter jet escorting her. And he would fly so close to the real plane that the tips of the wing are only like this much apart, which is very dangerous because, you know, now that I know, right, any turbulence or anything, boom. To the point that her pilot would say, "My, please come up here and wave him. So send him
home. Off. Wow.
It's very dangerous." My mom, so she'd come and she waved, and he waves back, and then he would do the flip on the plane, flip, boom, and then he would go home. Now, that was the story we all knew, but it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I was talking to his co-pilot, who was in that. He said this, "You did not know this." Everybody know that, you know, that saga, but you did not know that when your mom's plane took off, your dad run up to the tarmac. The plane that he usually flew is not there. Whatever, there was the brand new plane that the American just came, a brand new plane. No one's ever tried it out. He said, "This is the only, let's get on that." And while he was flying, I was opening the manual book, side, opening the manual book saying, you know, and he did all that. But on the landing, it was boom, 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 boom. And just like that, he's going to go after, fly this jet for the first time. And I was hurrying up to sit, not side by side, but, you know, one in the front and one in the back, they have like this way. And he was going through the manual and telling my dad what to do. So that was that story. So that was just one saga. You know, the rest is just incredible. Yeah.
How did your mom get the sort of the training, the pedigree to speak the languages or to carry herself the way she did?
I think, first of all, that is a natural thing she has. And also because I've got to give it to her. She's constantly learning and striving to make herself better. My grandma was a widow. My grandma grew up not like at her time, she's not even sent to school. Okay. So she used to wash the zaptiwa. The mat by the river, and she was so poor that at times she just wanted to jump down the river and commit. So that's my grandma. So my grandpa was assassinated during the French Revolution or the Vietnamese French War or something. I don't know Vietnamese history because I never studied it. But then my grandma was a widow. So she and another grandma, because my grandpa has two wives, but during that time, they lived together like sister, big sister and older sister. And as a matter of fact, the second wife, my grandma is the one who married her for my dad. Because my grandma has a best friend. Both of them are in the war against the French.
French.
Both of them got assassinated. The wife of the best friend got assassinated first. So my grandpa came down to see her, and my grandma said, "Now that she's alone, well,
bring
her gotta in. Marry her back, right?" So they marry her, And so after my grandfather died, the two ladies were only in their 30s, like early 30s. They lived together, raised four children and through their life until they died. So, you know, they're poor, they don't speak the language, but my grandma had this thing, because at the time, my grandma was buying salt, mudmuya, salt, right? And whenever she goes over these check posts, because the other car, they have people who can speak French or something like that, they were able to go over, but my grandma cannot speak French. So sometime in the rain, and they have to use stick to stick in there to see what's in this cart, blah, blah, and all the salt pour out, and she would lose her whole day of whatever. So she promised herself that I cannot read, I cannot write, but all my children will read and write French and English and whatever. So she sent my mom and, you know, my uncle to the best school, you know. But here's another story also. My mom, when she was in Lycée Yersin in Dalat, was one of the prettiest girls on campus. And Lycée Yersin is a rich school. She said she had friends who are driven to school by chauffeur who would come in designer clothes, because it's one of the best school. My grandma sent mommy to a French school with a French name, Isabelle, but insist the whole school year she only has two outside, two pants. Not every day, where all the other kids were like in designer clothes. And my mom said that her house was so poor that one time she was driving her bicycle up this hill. And every day is like, you know, bicycle to school, like so many kilometers, you know. And her outside got caught in the wheel. Wow. And she fell, and the outside got torn, and she was scratched all in from body to here. She remember, driving, home and crying and coming into the house. And guess what? Grandma slapped her one more, because how dare you rip the outside? Wow. You only have two. And now I have to spend for your outside. So my mom grew up in that environment. And can you believe that in her 1920, like French school, English, like got, have to go through a lot of interviews and almost like casting, auditioning to get to the stewardess. And by the time she married my dad and she had me, she was only 23 years old. And now you see pictures of her, like when she's walking out, waving people, being this like first lady. 23 years old, self-taught everything. Even she learned how to cook when they were in Paris. She went and at the Sorbonne. So it's not that she takes a class, but you know how you can go in and watch and learn that
you can audit. You can audit the class.
Audit. Yeah, that's one thing. So learn from the Sorbonne and learn to cook all these French dishes. So when we're at home and every time we throw these parties for like these state dinners for like 20 or 30, we have all these dignitaries, all these important people over at the palace, the house. So she would like be in charge of these chef who can cook French food and stuff and know how to set the table, know all the protocol, know just everything that you know she's taught me, and all self-taught. Yeah, it's a drive, a motivation, a self-taught to better yourself. And yeah.
Okay, so I bring this up a lot, and this is sort of a topic, a theme that I talk about a lot, because I feel like you and I, our generation, we talk about your mother's generation, my mother's generation, much older, the struggles have transformed the way that they taught us. And we have inherited this beautiful story of struggle, the stories of struggle, and we are transformed and hardened, and things, beautiful things have come out of the struggle. Now, our children probably won't have that advantage almost. But you know, is it something that is worthy of you know, accepting not the struggle or not having the struggle? Is it something that we're okay with? I mean, if you had a choice, would you rather them have the struggles that we as the older generation have gone through? Or would you just rather have them have a normal, good life?
I think as every parent, right, we want our kids to have a normal, good life. But here's the thing. They will struggle. I think every generation has a different type of struggling. Maybe they might not struggle the things that we struggle, but something else, right? My parents, I don't remember the things that they go through to bring me here, you know, the starting all over in a new place without, the language, the money, going through the refugee stage, right? But now we have different struggles that our parents don't have, right? So I'm sure our kids will have. And, you know, like, for example, which kid can afford a house now in California?
Yeah, that's a big struggle.
Right? A struggle with social media, social bullying, with the different kind of pressure that that's going to come. And the sad thing is, as parents, we might not have the skills to help them in right. their world, because we don't do that. You know, my kids get on TikTok, they're doing things, I don't even know. And you know, they're cyberbully, that we don't know how kids can get together and do things, but I am sure they will struggle, because I believe that life is part of life is struggling for us to learn. Overall, yes. I believe that life is good. But I do believe that the struggles are there for us to appreciate when it's good. You know, for example, I was playing this game, Candy Burst or something, right? So I played the game, and there's this time that you can do so much, like in 1 minute, right? So like I get so stressed, oh my God, 1 minute. And then I set on the mode that the other mode is called relax mode. That mode, you can take your time, you can play, but you never die. And you know what? After a while, I got so bored of the never die mode. It's like, what's fun in playing this? So I go back to there and get stressed out. But I also know, as I'm stressing out, like, this is only a game, you know? So that is how I think life is. There must be struggle. There must be hardship. So it's fun. But at the same time, also know that you're going to be okay, because maybe we're living in a simulation. Who knows? Or maybe this is all a game. Maybe I'll wake up Matrix style, right? So who knows? Yeah.
You was it a struggle for you when you first started to go out and MC?
The origin story is that I had a photography studio. And this is not false modesty or something, right? I don't know how people perceive me, but every time someone said, oh, you're so pretty, Junior, I'm a bit taken back, because I never grew up thinking I'm pretty, because my mom is so beautiful, you know, right. And then everyone always said, oh, you look like your dad, so what do you think, you know? And you know, in Vietnam, and for the dark skin, for the longest time, I would have no teeth, you know, because all my tooth are just gone, because you know, anyway. So I grew up thinking, oh, I'm not pretty, right? So I never get involved in something that needs beauty. So I never want to become a model. I never want to be a enter any pageant. But photography is fun. So I started taking pictures. I have my own photography studio, and I know a lot of models. And these are not necessarily models, but college students, right? Who want to have a headshot. So I started doing that. And then one day I got a call from this nightclub, like at that time, just small Vietnamese nightclub. I don't remember, like Majestic, or you mentioned Diamond Ritz. Yeah. They said, well, why don't you come and put on a fashion show for us? Now the fashion show is just for fun, to bring in a customer. It's not like we're not professional. We're not selling clothes. We're not wearing any designer.
Right.
But they want to have a few beautiful girls on stage walking around. So then I gather my models and bring them there. And because I'm now like the head of the team, right? While they're walking on the stage, I'm standing behind the stage with the name card. You know, it's just like, Miss Tran, you know, how many, da, 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 and just bringing that. And some of the models, like I say, they're just college students too. So when Long Beach start having beauty pageants, And Anh Nam Lộc was the host, and they're looking for a female. Some of the girls recommended me. Oh, so Duyen goes, I work with her. She's an MC, but I wasn't really an MC. I was like behind the stage, you know. But I've done enough shows that they're okay. So, but it has always been, So that's how I got on stage, and that's how my my MC career got started.
But your Vietnamese at the time wasn't developed yet, right? It was just basic?
Yeah. So it was very easy. It was Vietnamese. It nói là, thưa quý vị, người mẫu kế tiếp, tên Quỳnh Thị Thu Trang, năm nay đang học ở Long Beach, và cô đang học vệ. So just like that. And I'm reading everything. So how hard can that be? You
right.
Know, that was the extent of my MC. Hay là, xin kính chào quý vị. And that's why now when I do the when I chọc phá, and you know I joke around and I copy some of the youngest kids who can't speak Vietnamese, that's because now when I MC pageants now for the younger generation, like 18, 19, when I ask them something in Vietnamese, of course they and I pick up the accent. So for example, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? In Vietnamese, con nghĩ mai mốt con lớn lên thì con nghĩ là con muốn làm bác sĩ, tại vì bác sĩ giúp nhiều người. So I pick up that. But here's the thing. It's not because they're not intelligent. When I see them struggling like that, I say, okay, em trả lời tiếng Mỹ đi. If you want, you want. Oh, yes. Well, when I grow up, I want to travel around because I think so they're very intelligent. But when in Vietnamese, they just can't express it right.
Right.
So I think so. I was one of those when I first started out. So I totally. Yeah.
Okay. So what does it take a human being to go from that to really world class in the way that you MC? Because it's the ideas that come from. I mean, language is a portal so we can understand thoughts and concepts. But if you are limited, you know, when you first start out, and then, you know, a few decades later, you are really at the top of the game for the whole world to see, it's on display. How do you, what kind of work is entailed in getting to that point?
I think if you've read Malcolm's book, Is it
Outliers?
Is it the tipping,
the tipping point.
Yeah. Or something. I've read all his books. It says that if you do something over and over for 10,000 hours, you'll be good at it. And I read that, and I was timing like how many shows I do a week, how many years I've done it. Mm. Right about there. He is right. He's got his research done. About 10, like for example, people could ask you, you know, you're doing your podcast, you know, how do you come up with a question, the interview? But if you count back, you know, you're very good now, but if you've done 10,000 hours, you will be, you know, up there with Oprah, you know. Or and the, another thing is, as an MC, people always think that, oh, you learn your lines, you learn to carry yourself, you learn, that's all, that to me is not important. The most important thing is you have to have knowledge in your head. So why someone can seem spontaneous, it's like, okay, you pick up something, you've read about certain subject, okay, then you can carry on, you have expert opinion that's in your head. So I read so much about anything, and even now when I don't read, I'm listening to audiobooks, YouTube, when I'm driving, every day I just have to have a thirst of knowledge. Every day I have to have something new that's gonna, in even for nothing, but just for the pure enjoyment of it. And then boom, a conversation comes up, I'm there. For example, you asked me, what have I been listening to this morning? Actually about quantum physics and the double slit experience and how energy, so it's got nothing to do with,
right.
But I'm just interested. I'm not gonna be a physicist, but I'm interested. I'm
curious.
Interested in, yeah, like the horoscope that they just sent out to space, you know, the one that's gonna go by the sun. So just general knowledge, but in everything.
So that's really the key. That's the key,
that's
is
the
to
key.
Have this
that's
curious mind.
Well, unless you're like your curious mind, so you can conduct interview. But let's say if you're an American MC, you might have 10 staff writers for you. It's easier. Vietnamese MC, I don't think any of us have staff writers. So therefore, you have to just put knowledge into your head, file it away, don't know where you might need it, you know, or yeah, something like, also this morning, I just learned that when a man gets really mad and he scream and yell, it's not because his testosterone level was high, but at that time, it's his estrogen level that's high. That's why he scream and yell and can't control and it, behaving like a woman. That's why Vietnamese say, "Ủa sao anh giống các bà, các mẹ? Are you behaving like a woman?" That is because the estrogen level is up. So people always think testosterone is you're aggressive. Not true. You're only aggressive to defend, fight and stuff. But when you're a real man, you're calm and you let your woman have the woman's moment. So yeah, things like that. I don't know when I'm going to need it, but it's in my head.
Oh my God, that's a whole nother episode right there. That estrogen conversation. That's very... highly igniting controversy. I mean, especially as it relates to Vietnamese men, you know, mm-hmm. our behaviors of, because I'm the same way. I'm just like my father. You know, we forget that we need to be able to explain something in a very calm way for somebody to, our children, our wife to listen, our mothers to.
Well, I've been listening to John Gray, the man who wrote Man's of a Mark Moon. And he says right away, he said, the foolish thing you can do is raise your voice when someone is trying to listen to you. Because when you're raising your voice, you're saying, you're not listening to me. So I'm going to talk louder. Make sure you listen to me. On the other hand, hey, I am trying to listen to you. And you're telling that I'm not listening to you. So why should I bother? And he even said that it's very antagonizing. Yeah. Because when a man yells, a woman will take it as an act of violence.
Yes.
And I used to think it's just me. Well, am I being too difficult? You know, I've been in conflicts where my partner would actually raise his voice at me, but I knew he would never hit me for sure. And I'm thinking, well, is that okay? Now I know it's not okay. Mm-hmm. That I'm not being said. Other women are reporting that when a man yells at you, that is an act of violence. And unlike physical abuse, mental abuse is so deep. Like you can say sorry, but the words that you say are cutting and it hurts. So, and also because a man is so much bigger than a woman, that when he's sitting there like yelling at the top of his voice, he does scare the woman. So just be mindful of that, you know? So those are the kinds of things that I learned to better my own relationship first.
Yeah. And almost you can argue that when somebody hits you, it's just very, it's superficial, you know, but when somebody's yelling at you over and over and over, it's actually entering into your body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? So yeah. Yeah. So yeah, those are the things that I, you know, just read randomly every day. Yeah.
And I think being on a stage and being next to somebody like Anh-an is a muscle building exercise with somebody like that.
Yeah, and I'm so lucky because he is a professor, a teacher, so he explains everything so clearly, concise, and logically. And I have to say, everything I learned about Vietnamese history, learned growing up through Thuy Nga and through Anh-an, because Thuy Nga would have to pick a certain song. And then Anh-an would explain to me, why was this song there? What does it mean? You know, and yeah. And so both of that combined, I think I've learned most of my Vietnamese heritage. And like you say, what it means to be Vietnamese, I've learned from being in Paris by Night and through Anh-an and my mom.
You know, I don't know if you can answer this, but I've been following his career and I know that it's coming to an end. How do you replace somebody like that?
I think it's hard. But if you don't try to replace, but you try to find someone new, like just a new MC, and that person has to develop whatever that's going to attract the audience on his own. Let's say Anh-an, his is this professor, this head of knowledge, this life encyclopedia, you know, and that is what attracts the audience. Now, if you try to be like Anh-an or be like Ki Duyen, that's that's a failure already. Right. But if you have something on your own, like I see like a Ryan Seacrest, very different from my Ngan, right? But
right.
an outgoing young
bubble.
Bubbly. Yeah, so I think it's if you say to replace him, I say never, or to replace anyone. But you can have a different version that is just equally nice, but in a different direction.
And can we talk about any potential? Is there somebody that the company has in mind?
I don't know. I don't know. As for me, it's not just the potential. Definitely, I have never felt the chemistry with anyone that I've co-MC than with Ngan. There's also that chemistry, yeah. you know, that because he's like the big brother, the little sister. Things he can say to me, like, let's say if I'm standing with a co-MC that's around my age, then that person have to be a bit more gallant and gentleman and can't say things in my face. It might seem too harsh, but Ngan can say it as an older brother. And people can sense right. that, oh, we're just kidding, poking each other. Mm-hmm. He didn't mean that. And the audience laugh without feeling like any mean and intention from both of us. Like even he said, you know, things we can say to each other, but people know that we don't mean it. Now, right. I don't know. And I'm looking forward to see who Tinya will marry me off to next.
Right. That is such a nerve-wracking thought if I was in your shoes.
Really?
Yeah, I would be afraid to change. You know, for me, if I was sort of quote-unquote married to somebody on stage for all those years to find a new partner to dance with, that would be a very, because, I mean, your job and the performance really does rely on this dance partner that you have on, that you've been working with.
Well, to me, of course, I wish to stay with that partner for forever. But should it something not, then yeah. I'm looking forward to, like, oh, I don't know what's next. You know, I like changes. I like the unknown. I like the next day to sort of be like a present.
Right.
Like it will be boring if we know it's going to be exactly like yesterday, the day before. So, yeah, go with the flow. Sure, you love what you have, but if one day you lose it, whatever it is, whether it's a partner, whether it's your youth, whether, you know, I'm getting to that age. I'm in my mid-50s, you know. So it's okay. It's okay to grow old. It's okay to get wrinkles. It's okay to accept one day you're not going to be on stage anymore,
right.
but you're going to do other things. And it might be nice not to have to worry about, oh, you know, staying in shape and, you know, doing all these things. So I think change is good. Yeah.
Was there ever a time in your work on stage that it went pretty bad or horribly bad?
I don't know if maybe it's me. I mean, there were times when they were shooting in the audience, you know, we were in Long Beach and this guy fell from the second floor, which is like way up on the last row on the second floor. And he fell down to hit the people on the first floor.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, I mean, little things like that. You know, there are a lot of times when we're on show and we at the end of the show and we don't get paid and we turn around and the promoter's already, you know, skipped the place. You know, I was in this one show, I was talking, I was like, boop, you know, they turn off the sound because they said, you know, the promoters did not pay us for the sound yet. So we're going to turn it off and I come back and said, no one's getting paid because the promoter just took off.
Oh my God.
I mean, things like that. Yeah, I've been. You know, I was in a show in Holland or it's in Europe, I'm not really sure, but it's the first show Ngan and I were over there. So many people showed up that they fought each other. It was like a mad scene. They
Holy
fought
cow.
Each other to scrambling over tables and stuff. They broke in through all the doors around the stadium and just shoved in there. To the point where what is equivalent of a National Guard has to be called. So over there, there's like a lot of gangsters. So that was like, they send in like 400 National Guards with rifles fighting with all the audience, you know? I remember I was standing on stage, boom, 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 the two National Guard came on stage. And at that time, we were traveling with our own security. So there was two security, this was big German guys. And luckily for them, whenever they go somewhere, they would case out the joint to see like, where's the best. And these German guys are also from the military background. And that they came as our personal security guard for the whole, you know, the whole
tour.
The singers and mm-hmm. Tour, because we're going 9 cities. So we're standing there, they shove us into this closet or something. And I remember Tommy Ngo, you know how big Tommy Ngo is? He was walking behind waiting for Linda or something. Linda's always late. One guy grabbed him like this, like boom, shove him in the, and close the door, but boom. We just hear people say, and when it's done, the whole auditorium, and it's a big one, it's a professional auditorium, like the Surgery Home Center, broken glasses everywhere. Everywhere, yeah. And then towards the end, you know, Ngan told me, he said, you know what? I know I didn't do, but I think I contributed a little bit. I said, you know, I was walking around backstage and I see all these audience like, oh, please let it was cool. Juliana, I haven't seen you. So, you know, I opened the door and let a few people in, just one or two. So I don't know if they come back and let everyone in or what.
That is so funny. I mean, and this went on like in the middle of the show it happened or the beginning of the show?
And then we just started the show and boom. Well, I would say, a couple of songs into the show and we saw the guards coming up, you know, with guns and stuff. And the promoter shows, the local promoter, because when we go to a European tour, we have our main promoter and he would sell the show to all these little promoters. We only get paid from him and we only know him. Sometimes when he gets to a city, and the local promoter didn't pay up, he was like, everybody get dressed, but don't go on stage. So we're like, okay. So once he get the money from the local promoter, now green light, you can sing, right? So after we left, the local promoter said he has a Mercedes. They totally smash his Mercedes, like to bits. Yeah, so.
Incredible.
See, like all these things, it happens to me. I look back. But I never have anything that, like someone cussing at me or something happened between Ngan and I or the people. It was just, it's just actually fun memory, but it's not something that I like regret, you know, having. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you never said anything wrong on stage or, you know.
I mean, mistakenly say like names of singers, name of composer loads of times. Yeah.
No, but I'm talking about making a comment that is like supfam or offensive.
No. That I've been lucky. I've never. I don't know if other people would take certain comments as being offensive. I don't know, but for myself, I see the role as an MC. This is different. As an MC, I am not up there like a news reporter or a newscaster or someone who's going to give my opinion on something important. As an MC, my job is to always make the person I'm introducing look good. And even in my questioning, like a lot of time, if they can't answer, it's to come in and help them, you know, with their thoughts. So it's never about putting down whoever I'm standing next to, whether it's my singer or an interviewer. I always have to, if anything, bring them up because that's your job, and then have a fun time with the audience. So it's always lighthearted, fun. It's never anything serious, you know, it's never anything serious. Yeah. And if it's serious, it's only because the audience take it that way. Yeah.
So we know that there are differences between the societies all over the world that Vietnamese communities inhabit. There has to be a difference in Europe versus United States versus Vietnam. Can you tell me about some of the differences in the public and the way they receive the performances or the shows that you have been part of?
Oh, yeah. Okay. One thing is that the singers overseas, I feel that they're a lot friendlier towards each other. Like we can work for Thuy Nga, for Asia, Anh Vân Sơn. But aside from work, like let's say Hương Thủy would throw a party at her house, everyone would come, you know, and we're like exactly like the term là giữa nghệ sĩ đó là ai cũng là gia đình hết. Like everyone is a family. We're not, despite, so there's no competition there, you know what I mean?
Right.
And we compete, but of course you try to do your best. But let's say as an MC, I hang out with Yang Ngọc or now Ngọc Hân, like chị. So we all, and it's never all because Yang Ngọc and now chị Kỳ Duyên, you know, we're all very friendly. Whereas I noticed that in Vietnam, I'm talking about trong nước because, you know, Europe and Australia, it's also like overseas too. You would say not only from the singers, like let's say the top tier singers, some of them would say, oh, that singer would never go on stage with that singer. And you see it down to that makeup artist. They don't like that makeup artist, you know? And there's a conflict. But here's the thing. It's not their fault. It's the society that they live and work in. When those same singers come to America, oh, they're friendly. They're sitting together, drinking and doing show and having no problem. So why? Because in Vietnam, we have the paparazzi for celebrities. So like the In Touch, like the People magazine here. So to create news and online news. So for example, Diva A is singing on a show with Diva B. The next morning, the headline would say, oh, Diva B totally, you know, outsang Diva A. Or, oh, Diva A has a prettier dress and look at the way Diva B is dressing, blah, blah, blah. So they go on and let's say on a Facebook, a lot of us, we either do it ourselves or we have managers and stuff who would like repost those articles, right? For on our fan page. And then the fan of Diva A would come in, start cussing out this thing that this newspaper wrote about Diva B being better. It's not even Diva B saying that. It's cussing, and then the fan of Diva B comes up, and then after a while, Diva A and Diva B, they don't want to talk to each other. And they would do, I've heard like really rude things. So for example, two divas would be on a television show together, right? So Diva A would have her audience sit in a position where everyone can see. So, but when Diva B comes out and the camera's panning, all of Diva A's fans to show their, you know, they
allegiance.
Would be looking down here and not, my purposely God. Not looking at Diva B and just show an attitude. And of course, Diva B's fans go, blah, blah, blah. So therefore, why would Diva B want to like have lunch or sit and talk with Diva A? So it's the whole thing that draws people, it pulls people apart, and it pulls that base on always writing articles about differences, about if they would hear, you know, we all gossip, you know, celebrity. I could be sitting here, yeah, gossiping or saying something bad, you know, or something about a person. And I admit I've been guilty of doing that. But my conversation might be just to a friend that I heard. Now, in Vietnam, somehow that friend or somehow the news would leak out to a newspaper. Oh, I heard, you know, number A, you know, in a private conversation, you know, would say this and this, and then boom, 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 there we go again. Because it's the scandal, it's all these things that gets quick. You don't blame them either, right? If you say, oh, you know, Diva A, Diva B, so sweet to them, they're going out to lunch and da da da. Nobody wants to read that thing. So they have to think of the headline, have to be something that is provocative, scandalous for people to click on. And they're constantly looking for stories like that. So therefore, the celebrity and the singers just kind of keep to themselves. Here overseas, we don't have that kind of, we don't have a fan club, and we have a lot of fans and stuff,
right?
But not a fan club who would like do everything for you, and we don't have celebrity magazines. So yeah,
you know, that was the same problem that got really out of hand in the 90s with East Coast West Coast rappers. And people killed each other. Yeah, the promoters of these, like the Vibe or the Source, were two newspaper magazines, and they wrote things that were sort of bending the truth about rappers. And, you know, a lot of the rappers came from gang backgrounds.
Right, killing
each other quite a bit. But it sold newspapers, it sold magazines, it sold stories. And most importantly, it sold albums. So I think sort of like the same thing that we do on a very visceral, on a guttural level, we have an allegiance to certain. But that's sort of like the...
In Vietnam, there are managers and agents who would purposely create a scandal. Like there was this movie, I think last year, a couple of years ago, they purposely create a scandal, whereas the two lead role would have a romantic interest in each other. Well, I believe that they have partners already or something like that. So the audience boycotted the movie because, you know, they had loved to see these actor and actresses already have their happy family or something, you know? And the movie lost so much money that actually the producer of the movie are thinking, I don't know if they did at the time, they were talk of suing the manager and the agents of the different actors of coming up with these things, which is not even true.
So you see,
they think that we'll sell tickets and stuff, but sometimes it backfires. So there's a lot of those things going on, which we don't have here overseas.
So yeah, kabul, got you, right? It's a good and a bad thing.
Yeah.
Why don't we have that sort of fan clubs or that those kind of publications for Vietnamese America or diaspora people around the globe to follow? Or has there been a publication like that before?
I think just because we don't have enough people to make it worthwhile, you know? I mean, you look at some of the Vietnamese newspaper here, you know, the staff is very limited. A lot of times, I would say 90% of the time, it's a translation of, you know, Router News or whatever.
Right.
But we actually, you asked me, do we have legitimate newspaper reporter? I think very few. And those people who make a living as full-time reporter, they're going to report on the more important issues, right, of the day.
Right.
Issues that's got to do with, I don't know, with Vietnam, with politics, with this and that. Who has the time to go see what Zuin is wearing today, you know? Or, you know, so yeah. We just don't have the number or the reporters to do that.
So what do you envision as sort of the bridge or the next step for your work life?
Because I've started a few episodes on my YouTube, things about relationships, about things that I've learned, struggling, going through myself, whether it's about relationships, about things that I felt so much happier since I've learned, like meditation, like eating right. I would like to share more of those. And it's not something that I came up with myself. It's just researching from reading other people who are real experts, but maybe those books aren't available in Vietnamese, or maybe it is, but no one has the time to sit through and read it. So I'm reading it, I'm distilling it, I'm taking the core, the meaning, the things that I've gone through and it helped me to explain it. So I'm hoping to do more of that, because I think that you can, but only to a certain extent of people's physical reality. I mean, you can do a lot of charity, you can give them a piece of bread, whatever, but to find true happiness, you have to change people's mind. You can be a billionaire, but if you think that I'm sad, then you're going to be sad. You can have nothing, but if you think you're happy and content, you will be content. So I think as my second step, I would like to share what I've learned and what it has helped me. And if it helped you too, then I think a little bit, I think if you feel happy on the inside, then you will have that love to give out. And, you know, everyone affects everyone. And hopefully, you know, who knows what is like a pebble in the pond, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It sounds very similar to Oprah, that trajectory, that path is Oprah's, Oprah Winfrey.
My heroine. Yeah. I love her. Yeah. Right now I have on my Facebook page, 3 million people following me. So I think that, yeah, if I can, any subject, you know, whether it's what they're just listening to us and realizing that when a man raises his voice yelling, a woman take it as an act of violence. If they realize that and say no, and later on, maybe I'll talk about the tools that you can use so that you don't have to yell. If things like that happen and it lessen the domestic violence in the home, just imagine another generation of kids that's going to come out from that happy home and how that would affect, you know, the world. So I think that I'm blessed enough and I'm lucky enough to be given this platform. And I want to use it for something constructive.
Yeah. Well, as you're developing that throughout the next year or a few years, I'd love to bring you back on to discuss, you know, how that's going and really get into it, because that's something that I'm very interested in the way you're going to develop it. And I want to hear about how you approach that platform, because I think it is changing. It will change and transform society in Vietnam for the better.
Yes, especially in Vietnam. I'm all about women's, you know, women's right, women's lib. And I wouldn't even say now woman's right. It's woman's worth. You know, it's right. It's how, yeah, how worthy you feel. Yeah. And I hope to improve that, especially for Vietnam.
And that's a beautiful way to reframe that narrative.
Right.
Yeah, the worth. And that's...
Yeah. Yeah, because when you said woman's right, it seems to me like you're demanding something.
It's almost antagonistic.
Like it's out there. That's mine. It's my right. Yeah. But you don't have to. But you say, hey, you know what? I'm worth it. And because I'm worth it, I love myself enough. I'm not going to put up with that. You know, and then it seems nicer. You're not taking anything from anyone. You're just elevating your status. Yeah, I think.
Yeah, these are beautiful topics. I want to thank you so much for today. We are going to move into the Vietnamese segment. So I'm going to say bye right now.
Okay.
And, you know, thank you so much for coming on. And hopefully we can do this again very soon.
All right. I hope my English is okay. I haven't spoken this long in English. It's such a long time. So.
You have done amazing. That's now being so modest, but you're amazing. I really enjoyed this and really got to really hear you articulate a lot of your thoughts. And I'm sure that a lot of people my generation has not had a chance to hear you speak this eloquent
this
in English.
English.
And I mean, we all know what a master you are in Vietnamese, but I mean, to hear this side is, I really am honored and thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Okay,
bye
audience. Bye, G.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcast. Thanks again for listening.